Well, we played a video last week in my absence when I was in California. So the object of that is to show that we can stand toe-to-toe with conventional science on a lot of these issues. Now, the fact of the matter is that conventional science is not too interested in having biblical creationists publishing, particularly in their own refereed journals. So it's an uphill battle. Basically, they're the gatekeepers. They control what is or is not going to appear in their journals. And Scientific American, ironically, was originally founded to propagate a Christian view of science. And that was the case up until the last two editors got control of it. And the last two editors had very, very different ideas. They specifically will not put anything in by a creationist. If someone puts a creationist idea in there, or regardless of the merit of the paper, because it's controversial and doesn't follow the existing paradigm, that is, a worldview that science propagates, it is disallowed and rejected, and they advise that you go somewhere else. One of the interesting blanket results of this is that evolutionists can always say, well, if creationists were so right, how come they can't publish in journals? But the censorship has been well documented that this is the case. So we
would not hire Forrest Mims for their amateur science because he's a Christian.
Correct. Yes. And it's ironic in the case of Mr. Sims that he got such high marks until they found out he was a creationist. Yeah, and then all of a sudden he was persona non gratis, right? So yes, I did want to take some questions from the tape, and I wanted to also go for a general overview of what's going on in this whole arena of thought. And I put up some terms on the board, and I'd like for us at least to get a grasp of what's going on with them. Y-E-O-E. Those are real simple. That's young earth and old earth. There's two basic models how to take the book of Genesis in particular. And we talk about the young earth creationists and the old earth. What's the big difference? Well, the young earth people, and I'm one of them, so don't make any mistakes when I talk about them, hold that the earth is probably nowhere older than 10,000 years maximum, maybe 6 to 10,000 years in that range. In other words, not too far off from Archbishop Usher's very controversial date of 4004 B.C. As the date. Now, most people criticize Archbishop Usher primarily against an old earth background, but the fact of the matter is Dr. Usher's scholarship is actually far superior than that of most of his critics, because he dealt honestly with the genealogical data in Genesis. Because really what's at stake here is the first 11 chapters of Genesis, ultimately. Most Christians are okay with Genesis 12 and forward. It's just that first 11 chapters that people always get ground up on, and therefore you either have to be dealt with as they are, pretty much taking them as they stand, or some effort must be mounted to explain them in a way that accommodates something other than what they seem to say on the surface. In other words, the prima facie meaning of the text looks to support a young earth, because there's no mention of billions of years. Is there a way to get billions of years out of that place? Well, there's several ways, and we're going to actually show on the old earth side, because I try to be fair in presenting these things, what the models are. Dr. John Philip Lange, German scholar who published his commentary about the turn of the century, 1900, he believes that there is what's called, and this is an interesting word, Olamic language in Scripture. What is Olamic? Well, Olam is the Hebrew word for eternity, for enormous epoch of time. And he found evidence of the word Olam being used in several places in the Psalms. And he says it looks like there's an Olamic grammar and an Olamic language that is being cited here in these Psalms, and is evidence of the fact that long periods of time could well be connoted in it. And therefore, that's a support basis, for example, in Mr. or Dr. Lange's case. What usually has happened, and this happened particularly in the last century, is that there was a revolution in geology. The revolution in geology by Lyell and Hutton and the others basically started to trend away from a catastrophic idea that Noah's flood configured the features of the Earth. And as opposed to that, what you see now, the processes at work now, are really the ones that have always been at work, what's called uniformitarianism, that we don't see a gigantic flood, we rather see very small changes over time, and simply extrapolate those changes backward in time. And you say, instead of cutting the Grand Canyon in a matter of 2 weeks, because it's flood sediments that are very soft, and the rate of speed of the water is thousands of cubic miles an hour, scouring it out very, very quickly from receding floodwaters, for example. Well, that's also possible, too. Certainly, where the mid-oceanic rift is concerned.
Before you get too far, when you speak of our 10,000 years, okay, are you saying this includes all the other planets in the universe?
Yeah, that would include the other planets. And there's a good reason for that. I believe that our evidence actually gets as strong heading away from the Earth looking at other objects. Here's a case in point, and I think this is a very interesting example. It has to do with the rings of Saturn. Everyone knows the beautiful rings of Saturn, right? What's interesting about the rings of Saturn is that there are actually several independent rings, and they have gaps in between them. They call them the A and the B and the C ring, and there's the Cassini division, which is a gap between rings B and C. And the thing that's interesting is that the rings are not yet stable. Why is that interesting? Well, what's happening is that the rings, they're kind of like a flat ring, and the ring is getting flatter and getting wider and wider. So the inner part of the ring is getting closer to the planet, and the outer part of the ring is getting a little farther away as it's getting thinner and thinner. It's getting thinner and thinner because the rocks and ice chunks that make up those rings are bumping into each other, and each trying to find a separate orbit around the planet. So in this process of getting more and more stable, the rings flatten. And the rings are not yet flat. They're still going. They're still in the process of trying to stabilize. The reason that's significant is that scientists, starting with the Russian Fesyastsky, have attempted to calculate the time it takes to stabilize the rings. And they've never gotten a number under, or rather over, 100,000 years. They're generally shorter than that. What does that mean? Well, if the rings take 100,000 years to stabilize and they're not yet stable, that means, by definition, they are younger than 100,000 years. They are presumptive proof that the rings of Saturn are a very, very new feature in the solar system, because they would have stabilized long, long time ago had they been anything other than relatively newly created. So you have testimony in the sky about these things. Another interesting point about them, they said, well, there's a way to get them newly created, isn't there? Yes, there is. Turns out that the rings could have been caused or formed by a planet wandering too close to Jupiter. Jupiter and Saturn, both of these planets are so enormous that they got gigantic gravitational fields. You've already heard, you know, you'd weigh so many times heavier on Jupiter, you'd be crushed flat because of their enormous mass. I mean, you weigh so much, many more times. And this is true that when a planet wanders in, say a big chunk of ice wanders into too close to Saturn or Jupiter, the tidal force difference between the front and the back end of the planet is coming in would be enough to tear the ice chunk into pieces. And it's called Roche disruption. And the Roche limit is the point where if you get too close to the planet, the tidal forces on anything coming in that close will crush the object. And that's how the asteroids were presumably generated, because something wandered too close to Jupiter and got disrupted in the Roche limit, and boom, it went into little bits and pieces. So they say it could be that a giant chunk of ice, about a little bit bigger than our moon, probably wandered on in. Trouble is that the formulas for this Roche limit, as they call it, require that there's a minimum amount of mass for the incoming material. And the size is all wrong. The amount of mass in those rings is off by a factor of 8. to account for having been caused by that. So it looks like a planet wandering in and getting disrupted by the Roche limited Saturn, in this case, doesn't explain the effect. So it looks like they're created, and if the rings are about as old as Saturn, the assumption is they probably came into existence with Saturn, because the Roche limit explanation has fallen apart. Well, they've explained it sometime in the future. You have to understand that this is the standard answer for evolutionists. They don't have too much choice because they don't have, for example, a divine revelation to tell them so, what God did. So they have to intuit it for themselves. And whenever they end up with a problem, they basically say, we'll figure this out later. You know, we don't despair that science can give us non-theistic answers to these problems. In fact, they have this caricature of the Christian position. They said, Christians believe in the God of the gaps. Have you ever heard that, God of the gaps? Kurt has. They say the gaps in human knowledge, that's where you impose your God at to explain the gap. He says, and we just believe that the gaps will slowly close over time. You know, 100 years from now, the gaps will be figured out. The interesting problem with humanistic science is the gaps are only growing larger. They're not getting smaller. You know, like a friend of mine, Christian, says, the more we know, the more we don't know. That's actually the fact that it's not so much the bounds of human knowledge that are increasing, it's the bounds of human ignorance that are on the march. And that's not too hard to countenance given some of the things that we see. So, yes, we don't limit it to... there's other factors. For example, in the Coma Cluster, when a certain series of stars activate or maneuver around each other gravitationally to form a system, there's an effect known as velocity dispersion. It means eventually they will break up. They won't stay in a system because their orbits will eventually go into separate paths. And they can calculate the velocity dispersion for different star clusters. According to modern calculations, the latest, which have since been confirmed just a few months ago, the velocity dispersion time for the Coma Cluster to break up is on the order of 10,000 years. So it's still together. Again, presumptive proof that that star cluster is far too young. It doesn't make sense. In fact, galaxies ought to wind up. You see all these beautiful galaxies with these wonderful spiral arms, and they show these wondrous pictures, and you ask, how long does it take before those arms finally wind up into nothing? Because, of course, the inner stars are moving faster than the outer ones. It's a well-known tidal effect. And the answer is one to three revolutions. Again, this means that the 20 billion year universe doesn't fly. It does not fly on mechanical grounds, and the galaxies don't make sense. You ever wonder why they talk about the missing mass in the universe? They say all this mass is missing. It's because without that missing mass, there's only one other answer to the problems that's posed by the missing mass. This. And that's unacceptable. So they'd rather say that 90% of the mass of the universe has never even been seen or discovered. Talk about just a quick ad hoc supposition to save your theory. It says, we believe that the mass is out there because if it's not, we got a problem. So it has to be there. And so they actually propagate the missing mass theory on faith. It's dark, it doesn't radiate, we can't see it, but if it's not there, things look too young. That's the basic problem. That's the real gist, because if the universe were only 10,000 years old, you would not need to invoke missing mass at all. It's only required here for the old Earth people. And now it's not just we need 5% of the universe's missing mass that has never been seen or detected. It's upwards between 80 and 90% of the universe is this unknown material. Now, science is from the Latin word scientia, which means to know. And they always talk about the scientific thing, principle, right? We actually measure. We're empiricists. We take experiments. We believe what the instruments tell us. We don't go into wild speculation. Oh, really? Why is the mass missing? It's missing only because they have a commitment to a theory, and the theory is more important than the evidence. So they'll invent the evidence and then hope somewhere along the line someone rescues them and finds them some missing mass. Meantime, it's one of these deep, dark trade secrets of astronomy. There's more interesting ones than that, by the way. How many people have heard of quasars? And I don't mean the television set. Quasars. Quasi-stellar objects considered to be the farthest objects away. Would it surprise you to know that in 1976, a Canadian, he lives in Canada, but I believe he's Indian extraction, Yatandra Varshni, doesn't sound like a Canadian name to me, I don't know what that's all about, but there it is. Varshni published a paper. He actually did some of the most in-depth early studies on quasars. And he does not believe that the quasars are far, far away. And why does he not believe that the quasars are far, far away? The reason he's not a believer in the Standard Model is that he was able to study the quasars, and he basically divided their spectroscopic, in other words, their brightness, by their red shift, and determined that all these quasars can be grouped into 57 groups. Each of these groups is a concentric shell. It is like a shell that's exactly centered on the next shell. 57 times, 57 concentric shells all centered on our position. He says it's impossible that that could be a random coincidental effect. He says, this is known as the quasar distribution problem in modern astronomy. Why do the quasars fall on 57 shells that are centered on our location? If you move elsewhere to another galaxy and do the measurements, say one of our sister galaxies like Andromeda or M31, same name, and did the same measurement, you would not see the shells. You only see them here. Why are they centered here? Yes? Well, we can't get the resolution that close. We usually say it's the Earth galaxy system. It's within, we're within the galaxies. In other words, if you step outside the galaxy, you wouldn't notice the effect. But because it's such a gross effect, we could be centered directly on it. But it shows that there's something central about our location, no matter how you cut it. Even if it's just the galaxy, that's too close. It's a needle in the haystack. Why would 57 things be lined up on this position? Again, showing centrality of where we live. Now, as a geocentrist, it's consistent with my views, for example, which are quite controversial.
I'm not sure what you mean by the shells.
Oh. You study about 1,500 of these guys, and you would, this is looking at this two-dimensionally, you would find, for example, in this first shell, there would be a series of quasars at this distance, say X.
The first series of quasars be a certain distance from the Earth.
Right. And then you find another range of quasars, and they'd be another distance, but it'd always be a
shell. Nothing in between.
Nothing in between. In fact, this effect is back.
The shell is created by the position of the quasar, or imagined by the position of the quasar.
Correct.
Not that they're rotating around the shell.
Right. There's another effect that has entered into the fray that has to do with galaxies. It was determined that this exact same problem in a different way has appeared with all the galaxies that are around us. It's called redshift quantization. Basically, they thought that redshift, which is supposed to mean a function of how far and fast things are moving away from us from an alleged Big Bang. I use the word alleged because I think there's enormous problems with the Big Bang theory. On just pure physics grounds, apart from astronomy, that we should have at least a continuous range. In other words, we should see galaxies flying at 5 million miles a second, and then 5.5 million, and 6 million, and everything in between. And they don't see that. They see it basically in jumps. They see things traveling, say, at 10 million miles a second, or whatever it might be, 10 million miles an hour. The next batch will be at 23.5 million miles an hour with nothing in between. Then it'll jump to 51 million miles an hour, and there's nothing in between. And then when they look at these shells of galaxies, they're still centered on the Earth's position. So both the quasars back in 1976 testified to centrality of the Earth's location, and now galaxies are doing the same thing.
Mark?
Yes?
You mentioned these support the geocentric?
Yeah.
Don't they also fully support the heliocentric?
Do these... Because of the resolution issue? Yeah, they're inconsistent with both. They're consistent with both. I'm simply saying they certainly are consistent with both models. So I'm not saying it's not fair to make undue capital of it one way or another because the resolution is not fine. Resolution on other points, for example, Michelson-Morley experiment and other things, come into play there. So, final answer to your question, Elisa, is that indeed we can look at things beyond the Earth. So when I say young Earth or old Earth, Y-E or O-E, that could mean young universe and old universe. Just that the emphasis came in the last century due to geology saying we need, you know, we should go with an older Earth using uniformitarianism. And then really what happened beyond that is that biology pushed the geologists saying we need an older Earth. If you actually chart the age of the Earth that's published in the books from 1900 to now, you'll see it's been growing. Did not start at 4.6 billion years in the year 1900. It's closer to 1 billion years, and it could get pushing up in order to give the time for evolution to occur, because evolution is allegedly needs time as its buddy. Need long periods of time. And the reason that there's so much controversy between young Earth and old Earth is the second we adopt young Earth, there's absolutely no way to evolve all those forms of life in the 10,000-year time frame. The jig is up, right? So people who propose a pretty biblical, literalist approach to Genesis have two ways to go. They can attack evolution head-on, like we saw Dr. Gish do in last week's tape on the fossil record, or they can undercut it, saying, you don't even have the time there. There's two ways, you see. You don't have the time to generate it, and even if you did, it wouldn't work. That's the two approaches. So it's the kind of a two-pronged attack on evolution. But many of our fellow brothers, and perhaps even those in our room, have certainly fallen in the right camp, the old Earth camp, because there's many ways to justify it biblically. Different approaches have been taken to try to say, perhaps we should not be at war with modern science. Maybe we should accommodate. Sometimes accommodation is good and sometimes it's bad. And so this is kind of one of those up-in-the-air questions that's not been resolved. And unfortunately, it gets more heated than probably it ought to be, because I think if Christians were less heated and more careful and cautious in their scholarship, you get a little farther in understanding, at least a mutual understanding. Because we can see, for example, where Dr. Lange comes up with this Olamic grammar. We have to at least respect some of that aspect, and I, as a young Earth creationist, do respect Dr. Lange's work on those Psalms. Unfortunately, they're not the same thing as the text of Genesis, but he makes a case, and it can't be ignored. So, let's take a look at four conventional ways to bring an old Earth perspective in. It's pretty obvious looking at Genesis 1, first few chapters, the days of creation, that if those are literal 24 hours days, it's going to be pretty hard to find your extra 20 billion years. So there's different ways to achieve the 20 billion year approach. Now the top word I have is not so relevant to dating. That simply means that Christians who adopt an old Earth position generally take what's called a view known as theistic evolution, which is to say God used evolution to create. It's pretty much the simplest way to put it. And when we talk about the doctrines of creation and providence, here's where the mix is. Because we have a choice of where we draw the line between when creation stops and providence takes over. For example, right now, God is not creating more moons that we know of. He's not creating more people from dirt. Ended a long time ago, apparently. He's not setting stars in the sky. He's not causing the dry land to appear. Those were all done once for all. So we'd say certain things, once created, are then set in motion, and providence takes over, God's abiding governing. What actually happens with the theistic evolutionist, he says, I'm okay with creation and providence, God created all the raw materials, etc., but I like to move the line between creation and providence so there's more providence and less of creation. So, like Hugh Ross's position, God created the Big Bang and everything else flows out of that. So we basically are putting the dividing line between providence, God's governing care over things, and his creating them out of nothing and pushing it closer to the beginning. And this kind of approach allows us as Christians to adopt one of these old Earth views. Now that said, Dr. Ross does in fact believe in stellar evolution, galactic evolution, cosmic evolution, but he does not believe in biological evolution. He's an anti-evolutionist when it comes to biology. He spends a good part of his time attacking the notion that from fish to gish, as they say, or from goo to you, all these different names from clam to man. that those things don't happen. Frog to Prince, I like, is the one I like. Because Frog to Prince, instantaneous, is fairy tale, but Frog to Prince in 150 million years is science. Right? So, three theories, day, age, gap, and framework, are current. Gap theory was popularized in the last century, and it found its way into the Scofield Reference Bible. Now, the Scofield Bible is a dispensational Bible to start with. So it has other issues apart from the adoption of the gap theory. The gap theory basically says that we should reread Genesis 1 and 2, particularly verse 2, because he's okay with Genesis 1, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. But verse 2, he says, should not be read, and the earth was without form, but rather that the earth became formless, became a chaos. In other words, it was created beautiful, and then all of a sudden it became a void. And into this gap between the first and second verses of Genesis, he inserts the fall of the angels and the gigantic cataclysm that destroyed the universe and had essentially recreated all over again, because it was made beautiful and then got destroyed by the fall of the angels. Now, I don't know about you, I don't see the word fall of angels anywhere in the text. Yes, you're right, it's being imported. But that's what the theory is about. The theory says we can squeeze 20 billion years between these two verses. And I believe it's still in, though they mention other options, the newest Scofield reference Bibles. But it had been up through the 1975-1980 period until E. Schuyler English got the hold of the editorship of that particular Bible. So that's one way to get the 20 billion years in there. You squeeze them in between the two verses. And you change one word in the text, because there is a little bit of ambiguity in the Hebrew. Greek, you can't get away with that, but you can get away with a little bit of ambiguity on tenses, because after all, you have a consonants to guide you. The vowel points don't help you too much. So that's how you get 20 billion years in, Scofield style. The day-age theory simply says, well, let's quote from 1 Peter. 1,000 years is like a day in the sight of the Lord, right? As yesterday. One day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is like one day. Therefore, it could be that each of these days, Genesis 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, is many, many millions, maybe billions of years. We can squeeze it all in this way. The first day is really a gigantic geological epoch or era, and then we can squeeze it all in. The only problem with that theory, apart from the fact that when Moses quotes this in Exodus, he says in the space of 6 days, kind of is pretty clear, because he justifies the Sabbath principle on this. It's the following, and Hugh Ross is aware of this, and he's given us our counter-explanation. Remember I said you have to adjust things in the text to get these theories to happen? This is one of those cases, again, where instead of inserting a large amount of stuff between the first two verses of Genesis, here we have to say the fourth day has been misunderstood. Because there's no way on the third day you can have plants, and then on the fourth day create the sun, because there's apparently going to have a problem with sunlight and stuff like that. And since each of these are an enormous period of time, it means, that the plants have done without sunlight for quite some time. And so the answer to Dr. Ross, who's an old Earth creationist, the following. It's not that the sun and the moon and the stars were created and set into the firmament. It's the first time they became visible from the surface of the earth. It says really there was like this cloud, this Venus-like white cloud, and covered them up, and we never saw the stars until the fourth day. And that's the point in time where God, over hundreds of millions of years, caused that vapor to disappear, and lo and behold, the stars appeared, and the sun and the moon. So he changes the creation of the sun, moon, and stars to the appearing of the sun, moon, and stars from the vantage point of the plants on Earth. And that's the adjustment that has to be made in the text to get this off the ground. Twofold, days are not days, they're long periods. And two, the sun was not created on the fourth day. It merely was seen for the first time from someone who would have been standing on the Earth at that point, which would have been a plant. You know, take it on the corns of a word. That's common, by the way. This idea of what's called phenomenological language means the language of appearance. I really first got propagated in the 20s and 30s by Bernard Ramm in his book Scripture and Science, where he said all these problems in science can be solved if we just say these were very, very simple men, fishermen, sons of Pharaoh, as the case may be, and they just called it the way they saw it in the right in the language that they had. That's the reason or the justification used to explain this kind of thing. So they said this is really the case. So Dr. Ross propagates day-age theory, and it tends to be the most common thing, saying these were long periods of time. But one can see the problem if how you have plants without the sun for hundreds of millions of years. If the days are only 24 hours long, it's not a big problem. If God creates the plants on Wednesday and then the sun on Thursday, they can do fine for one day without the sun, can't they? They can't do fine 100 million years without sunlight, because photosynthesis requires sunlight. They can take, you know, the chlorophyll can, under that process, take water and carbon dioxide and make sugars out of it. Plants can live and make fruit. What's the framework hypothesis? That's the new kid on the block. It came up in the 1970s and 80s. It was propagated from within Presbyterian circles, or pretty close to, certainly Reformed Calvinistic circles. Our good friend, I use the word in quotes because I think he's mistaken on this, Dr. Meredith Klein, K-L-I-N-E, actually a pretty decent scholar on a lot of matters having to do with the Old Testament, particularly on issues of covenant. But here he grabbed the Genesis 1, and he discerned a poetic pattern in it, and here's what he did. See that? He's saying that essentially days 1, 2, 3 are the first stanza, and they in stanzas 4, 5, 6 are exactly the same territory. In other words, Genesis 1 correlates with Genesis, the first day of Genesis correlates with the fourth day. They are describing the same event. The second day of Genesis corresponds to the fifth day, and the third day of Genesis corresponds to the sixth day. They're equal. So it says you have to read them in pairs like this, and then you can understand it. He says, what these represent, and he used the word framework, said, think of a picture frame that's empty. He says, and then you basically are moving the picture frame around his history in two swipes, like this and like this. And then the thing that you see through the frame is what Moses is recording here. So it's just snapshot views, if you will, through a picture frame. And the picture frame is this poetic device that associates these days together. And this is another way of getting long ages, but we don't have the problem that Hugh Ross solved by saying that the Earth, the Sun, Moon, and stars weren't created. Rather, we have another problem, that the days are no longer sequential, are they? On the face of it, they look sequential. Anyone ever read any indication that the fourth day actually came before the third day or the second day? And how do you get there? You have to call it a literary device. That's what you got to do. And if it is a literary device, well, then you can justify this kind of act. But my view is it seems kind of gratuitous. Why was he motivated to do this? From a young Earth point of view, there's only one motivation for going to old Earth, and that's because the geologists and scientists tell you that you're crazy if you don't. That really it's a credibility issue, and that's the only reason that someone... And there's some truth in that insofar as that nobody was advocating an old Earth out of the Bible prior to the 19th century. Why did it come up at the time that the geologists started pushing the age of the Earth into millions and billions of years? Hard to account for 19th centuries of Christian scholarship not buying into the old Earth until science told them different. So it looks like we have what's called a double revelation problem. We have the problem of revelation from Scripture and then a revelation from science. It's called general revelation, we call it. From the created order. And apparently, the geologists and the biologists were telling us we're getting mixed signals. Now, in the view of most geologists, the only signal worth trusting is theirs, their estimate of the age of the Earth, not Scripture. So, from their point of view, you can already ignore what the Scripture had to say, yes.
Why are they coming up with this? The Earth is so old, and the geologists or whatever, what are they basing that on?
Yeah, we'll go into that. The problem with carbon dating, first off, is it can only measure ages well under 100,000 years. It's not suitable for anything large. If you want to have longer periods of time into the moons, you use krypton argon and rubidium system and then uranium decay. Just because the half-life of carbon 14 is not very, very good, changing it to nitrogen 14. So you use alternate methods. But you use carbon dating for relatively recent living things, bones, you know, when they're going into tar pits and things like that, that's ideal. You want to carbon date the Shroud of Turin. That's another case where you would use the carbon. It also has to have something that has carbon in it. Most rocks are inorganic. There's no carbon there to start with, so you couldn't even use the method, even if it could extend beyond 100,000 years, which it doesn't. And there's many, many errors with carbon dating. There's many solutions to the, and that's called radiochronometry. That's using the decay of various materials to determine how old things are. And creationists do not have a black eye on this area. They actually do quite well in countering the claims of radiochronometry. And Dr. Slusher had a wonderful technical monograph to this day. It's one of the better ones in this area. And Dr. Melvin Cook has been a strong critic of radiochronometry. And they have a whole problem of what we call anomalous ages. It's an anomalous age. That's when they measure something and it doesn't fit. And they measure something and says, this is only 3,000 years old. But looks like it came from a 2-billion-year-old piece of Precambrian Mendenhall gneiss. Gneiss, they call it G-N-E-I-S. This is a form of rock, the oldest rocks known. And some chunks of it simply are aged not too long based on the systems they use to measure it. They don't tell you about the dates that don't fit. They're just shrugged under the rug. But, you know, there's a point where the fudge factor gets too big. Did you know that when they attempted to prove general relativity down in South America by checking out that eclipse to see if the starlight had been around the sun, that they threw out more than half the data points? And if I'm doing a science experiment over at UT Austin and I threw out 63% of my data points and fudged, you know, 37% into my answer, do you think they'll give me high points as an objective scientist? But that's the level of finagling that we see in modern science. It's called the ethics problem in science, yes.
Martin, which of any of these theories would talk to, for example, in modern science, we know the half-lives of lots of different radioactive items, and we know what they are today, but what's to say that there was some discontinuity and it was different in some
Correct. In fact, that's this word here, CDK, that's what that's all about. What is CDK? That's kind of, what I put it, cute acronym. Because it really is short for, I keep losing my pen. I don't know if anyone can read that, especially with the podium and everything. CDK, as in the decay of C. And therefore, they shorten it to CDK. But that's not an acronym anymore, is it? It's just cute. But they call it CDK. It means the change of the speed of light over time, that the speed of light is decaying over time. And the rates at which radiological decay occurs is has C in its value, in the rate value. It's in the exponent of the natural logarithm. Use tech talk. And therefore, if the speed of light was faster in the past, then things decayed faster. And if it's slower now, things have the appearance of being billions of years old when they're not. So CDK is an interesting way to solve the problem. Now, CDK was essentially intuited by a fellow named Barry Sutterfield in Australia. And that's ironic, that's Australia. Sutterfield was looking at all the measurements of the speed of light that had been done since it was first achieved in around early 1600, 1630-ish, by Romer, who did the first measurement. And then he noticed that every time we've measured it since, up until the middle of this century, the value is always a little bit slower, a little bit lower, a little bit slower. And then they stopped measuring it optically and used an electrical measurement. And the electrical measurement, because it uses the speed of light in its calculation, showed it steady. So in his view, the speed of light had actually been very, very fast, probably infinite at creation point, and it rapidly dropped
asymptotically in an exponential decay. So he said, we're seeing the last stages of an exponential decay of the speed of light. And he pounded this theory, and he dealt with gigantic, lengthy tomes trying to get this view in. He showed how all the geological ages were going to fit in 10,000 years. He accounted for all the decay rates of all the radiochronometry indicators and the isotopes based on the correct half-life with the new corrections in them for CDK. And most people poo-pooed it. And the poor fellow even had trouble in some creationist circles, even young Earth creationist circles, saying, well, we don't want to hitch our wagon to CDK because it could be iffy. And if CDK is disproven, and most people thought that Barry Setterfield wasn't making much gain because he wasn't allowed to publish for openers in refereed journals because it was controversial, didn't fit, attacked Einstein in many respects, people decided to isolate poor Mr. Setterfield. I had a personal correspondence with him, and I think he had, apart from one part of his theory, I don't think he should hitch his caboose to general relativity as he did in his model, but everything else apart from that, he had a good strong case. But he couldn't get published. And he had a problem that credibility-hungry Christians weren't so willing to account for the problem using this. They had other explanations for it. This is interesting to me. Reuters, August 7th, 2002, just how many days ago? 4 days ago, right? Listen to this. A team of Australian scientists, by the way, this does not include Setterfield, has proposed that the speed of light may not be a constant, a revolutionary idea that could unseat one of the most cherished laws of modern physics, Einstein's theory of relativity. The team, led by theoretical physicist Paul Davies of Sydney's Macquarie University, says it is possible that the speed of light has slowed over billions of years. If so, physicists will have to rethink many of their basic ideas about the laws of the universe. That means giving up the theory of relativity and E equals MC squared and all that sort of stuff, Davies told Reuters. Of course, it doesn't mean we throw the books in the bin, because it's in the nature of scientific revolution that the old theories become incorporated in the new ones. And Davies and astrophysicist Tamara Davis and Charles Lineweaver from the University of New South Wales published the proposal in the August 8th edition of scientific journal Nature. Nature is one of the most respected British science journals. It's like the Physical Review for Britain, their top journal. And the suggestion that the speed of light can change is based on data collected by University of South Wales astronomer John Webb, who posed a conundrum when he found that the light from a distant quasar, a star-like object, had absorbed the wrong type of photons from interstellar clouds on its 12-billion-year journey to Earth. And then the discrepancy could only be explained if either the electron charge or the speed of light had changed. And there's trouble either way, as continues the article. So some other Australians, giving Setterfield no credit, said, we came up with this idea of CDK. And they want to get the credit for knocking down CDK. But it was a Christian who came up with it first. And his paper trail is very good, so he's got a cause to complain once this is confirmed that, hey, those were Johnny-come-latelys, right? So it's something that happened just this week confirming CDK. Now, they're talking about a change over billions of years, but that's already assuming that you get the billions of years because you're using a speed of light at a certain value. So it's kind of like circular reasoning. In fact, both sides, young Earth and old Earth, use circular reasoning. Don't think that's bad. It simply means that you don't ever escape your initial assumptions. You should always come something with consistent with your initial assumptions. The question is not, are we reasoning in a circle? Are we reasoning in a constructive or a destructive circle? That's really the question. Okay, so CDK, fascinating, and it's come back out of Australia, but not because of Setterfield. This time we have four scientists who are published in a scholarly journal, and now it gets attention. Not when the Christian published it. Not when the Christian had all his work cut out for him. Not when he had the uphill battle. But the people with the right seats and the right paradigm and the right conditions and the right data that suited British journal Nature, they were able to get in there and get it published.
So if you were an old Earth theorist and you accepted this new revelation or this new theory about the speed of light, did that make the Earth, under their theory, older or younger?
Younger. It would shorten the age of the Earth and the universe, all of it. Yes?
I have a question about the age theory. Is that more of a poetic reference? You know,
no.
The God is different from man. I mean, has no one considered just the idea that time is measurable different than it was maybe at the beginning of time? Like, you know, we know that as you go towards the center of a black hole, time slows down considerably. I mean, so maybe at the beginning, if we know that time can be altered as far as the pace.
I'll talk about that real quick, just because it's a technical point that you raise. Why do we think that when things speed up, you say, you know, the old twin paradox, someone goes off, and they even tell you that the Apollo astronauts came back, you know, a millionth of a second older than we were, or younger, whatever the phrase is. And we say, well, this is the reason we think this is the case. And this is why we believe Einstein was right when he used these equations. He said, when we send a particle very, very quickly, a muon, around a, not a cyclotron, but the equivalent of one of these big particle accelerators, cyclotrons aren't used anymore, they're toys, it should decay, say, in 1/1,000,000 of a second. But we see that it lasts 3/1,000,000 of a second. It lasts three times longer than it should have. It already should have fallen apart. It says, our conclusion is that time has dilated. In other words, time has slowed down for this particle. And I use the same explanation for the black hole because of the accelerations that are present. Here's the problem with this model. There's a beautiful alternate explanation for it. What is it? Why on Earth would this unstable particle take three times longer to decay as it's spinning around at this high speed? Here's the correct answer, believe it or not. And it's a classical answer. It was derived by Dr. Barnes of the UTEP, University of Texas, El Paso, and is confirmed by Dr. Richard Pemper, who was at Fermilab, and no small task to be achieved as a postdoc student at Fermilab up in Batavia, Illinois. And it's this. It's not that time is slowing down. It says as particle gets faster, it becomes more stable. Turns out the electric self-interaction of the particle holds it together, kind of like a magnetic restriction onto the particle, so that it's not so much that time is changing, it's that it is becoming more stable. It's being prevented from decaying because the magnetic field is tightening on it to prevent it from exploding into electrons and neutrinos at that point. So there's two interpretations of the effect. Either time is changing or the clock has now become more stable. So is it time dilation like Einstein says, or is it clock error? Is the thing actually more stable than the clock? We thought it was a constant clock, tick, 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 but really the clock is still going tick, 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 but it's more stable. It's not going to set the alarm off at 1, setting the alarm off at 3. See, clock error, not time dilation. And you don't need Einstein to get that explanation for the muon taking three times longer to decay. It's simply more stable the faster it goes. And it gets closer to the speed of light. The magnetic restriction effect on it that holds it together becomes infinite, and it'll never decay. And it'll look like time stood still. Because how do we measure its decay? By when it decays. Well, that's the point. We measure time by how long it takes to decay. And if the thing becomes more stable, it inherently won't decay on schedule. It'll decay as a more stable particle would, longer down the line. So. Okay. So the physics is lots of fun, as you can tell, and I can get glazed eyes.
I wanted to at least talk about punk eek. What is punk eek? Anyone know what punk eek is?
Band. A rock band?
No, it's not a rock band. Might as well be, right? Well, I'm pretty snooty. I actually subscribe to a Dallas paper, not the Austin rag, but they're both rags, I guarantee you. And this was in this week's edition, Evolution of an Idea, having to do with the recent death of Stephen Jay Gould. He's the Harvard paleontologist. He's an expert on a given snail. But he's also a very prolific writer on the area of evolution. And he finally published, just before he died, his book called The Structure of Evolutionary Theory. Turns out that he does not adopt gradualism. There's basically a couple of models in evolutionary theory, and one of them is gradualism. And this is the way we heard it from Darwin. Things slowly change. And you saw the problem with gradualism when you watched the tape last week, that Dr. Gish said, where are the intermediate forms? In fact, Gould himself, in the course of this article, calls the lack of intermediate forms the trade secret of paleontology. Quote directly from him. That's an interesting comment. Now, Gould, very smart scientist, said, let's make that negative into a positive. He says, I think that there is no such thing as gradualism, that things change actually happen suddenly, and there aren't any intermediate forms, because essentially when we go from reptile to mammal, it happened fast. It happened in a matter of a blink of an eye, now geological time. I mean, it could have happened in a matter of just 10 to 100,000 years, not 20 million years, so there wouldn't be any time for a lot of fossils to accumulate for this change. And fact, they even use this term hopeful monster. And people say, well, you know, it's not fair to credit, you know, Gould for propagating the hopeful monster. That means that a bird lays an egg and a mouse comes out of it, kind of thing. That's what hopeful monster is all about, something that radically rapid happening. Not quite that rapid, but you get the idea. Hopeful monster. That means all of us are monsters, by the way. And Gould says that. We're all monsters, essentially, in that model. Punk eek is short for punctuated equilibrium. Basically means that all the species are in equilibrium and they stay stable, but it's punctuated by little periods of time when there's rapid change. And therefore, critics of punctuated equilibrium say that's punk eek, because they don't like it. They say this violates basic tenets of Darwinism, and there's not a shred of theory for shred of evidence for the theory. Of course, the problem that the punctuated equilibrium has come up with, but there's not a shred of evidence for gradualism because the fossil record doesn't support it. The fossil record either supports punctuated equilibrium or creationism. And Dr. Gish propagated the creationist interpretation on the tape last week. And Dr. Gould propagates punctuated equilibrium along with Niles Eldridge and John Lewontin. These are top-notch paleontologists who propagate this from the atheistic point of view. I did mention before that it's ironic that Dr. Gould's top researcher was Kurt Wise. Kurt Wise is a creationist Christian. And he was Dr. Gould's right-hand man. So Dr. Gould did not mind working with a young Earth creationist. He says, and Dr. Wise's position was, Dr. Gould will work with anyone who does his homework and does careful research. He hates sloppy science. It's that simple. But they got along very well together, and Gould had a creationist as the right hand the entire time. Don't know if much testimony went on because, of course, Gould died, and I don't know where he ended up. God knows. But the fact of the matter is that if gradualism was here to stay, there would have been no interest to propagate punctuated equilibrium, would there? Especially without a mechanism to explain where that change is coming from. And there you have it. A lot of controversy because even the article itself says not many scientists want to buy into this because it sounds like a capitulation. Darwin said, yeah, we don't have too many intermediate forms, but over the next century we'll discover them. Well, now we have several million fossils very, very carefully organized across the face of the globe, and we're not getting those intermediate forms. Like Dr. Gish is fond of saying, show a picture of a slide 150-million-year-old bones and says, well, here he is, the world's oldest bat. And what is he? 100% bat. I love that. In other words, he's not half bat or three-quarter bat, 100% bat. And we had that problem across the fossil record. So why do we need the old age stuff, old Earth? It could be that Dr. Lange has something with his Olambic grammar. And that'd probably be the best way to get into explaining it. But you cannot take Genesis literally as it stands and arrive at OE. I don't see how you can. You must invoke some literary device, the gap, the day-age hypothesis, the days of Genesis, refer to days. And I think that's problematic because of this continual, and there was morning and there was evening. How do you fit those in? Those sound like diurnal periods, 24-hour days. Our own church confession adopts Moses' phrase out of Exodus, and that God created the heavens and earth in the space of 6 days. And I don't think they meant 20 billion years when they wrote that in the 1640s. Not likely. Gap theory, day age, and framework hypothesis. Now, right now, the framework hypothesis is all the rage, in the certainly in reform circles, because Klein has good credentials. He's a force to contend with, so young earthers have to hit him on that. What is the verse that is really the key for framework hypothesis? It's Genesis 2:5. What does that verse say? It says, and every plant of the field before it was in the earth, and every herb of the field before it grew, for the Lord God had not caused it to rain upon the earth, and there was not a man to till the ground. To him, this is the key critical verse, that there was not yet any rain. He says, why is there a mention here of these? Actually, there's two different words for plants. I don't know if you ever noticed that. The herb of the field are the cultivatable ones, and that's different from the wild plants and trees. And there's distinctions here between those that can be cultivated, two different Hebrew words. So Klein's position does not address that. He tries to lump them all together in one, as if all plants were the same, and they're not. There's two different kinds, the domestic and the wild. And then he tries to say, well, you know, if there's no water, we got a problem. And he says, therefore, he rearranged the days this way to allow for water for plants. I have to tell you this. The problem that he's talking about, the absence of rain, is not a problem if everything happened in a week, because plants can do without sunlight for a day, and they can certainly do without rain for a couple of days. Not to mention the mist that waters the earth in the first place that's mentioned. A mist came up of the ground and watered the garden before man started to till it. But the fact of the matter is, this is a pivotal verse for the framework hypothesis. But I think it's only cuts their swath, as you were, makes their case, because they already assume what they want to prove, which is long ages. If you adopt the early period of time, then the objection that there wasn't rain for a brief period is not a big deal. No rain for 100 million years is a problem for plants. It's like no sun is a problem for plants. He solves the sun problem because the sun's created on the same day as everything else, and the plants are way over here, along with animals. See that? And man. No problem. But the rain is an issue for him. And this is, and it's only an issue because he already has assumed it's an old earth. No. All that to say, all sorts of different systems, and remember we're trying to conclude our systems module here, contending for our attention, saying how we should categorize, systematize our thinking. What I'm trying to challenge you with is, it's not a closed book. Though young earthers have an uphill battle, certainly in the public eye, that doesn't mean that they don't have a strong case, maybe even too strong a case, because the official position of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science is we should no longer debate creationists. Stop debating them. You ask why they won't no longer want debates. The fact of the matter is, in their own internal memos, they say, we routinely lose these debates. We look bad in these debates. No strategy we've come up with has helped us look good in a debate. And they tape the debates, those Christians, and they play them to their friends, and they become apologetic tools. For example, Sidney Fox debated Gish at and Brother Falwell, the Liberty University, was there to introduce the debaters. That became a pretty famous tape. And Fox did not look good on that tape. And it was bad for science, modern science, because Gish was well prepared and systematic, and Fox did not do well. Have there been debates that have gone badly for creationists? I bet you they have been. I'm sure of it. I know some creationists who are not well prepared, who go out there and want to do debates toe-to-toe with the enemy, with the atheistic enemy, on science. And if you're not well prepared, don't go out. Because all you're going to do is, God's cause will be blasphemed among the Gentiles because you did not have a ready answer for the challenges that would come before you. So this is not for the faint of heart. We have good news. We have, for example, geneticists who are chairing the Harvard Department of Genetics that are creationists, younger creationists. So we have some people in high places, as I say. We have the king's ear, so to speak. That doesn't mean that it's an easy job for them. They're in a hard spot. But this is an ongoing controversy. Therefore, we need to be charitable in all respects. And dogmatism, very tough to hold it together, especially since we all see through a glass darkly, as I like to say. We all need to walk with the conviction we have now, the scripture that we have and understand, or as God may shed further light upon it. That's my final exhortation to you, is to allow further light to shine in this area as you work it through. And there's good materials out there on the web on both sides. Certainly, you can certainly, I'm not propagating saying you better be a younger creationist, you're not welcome in the class. That's not the case. But I'm saying be prepared to be, have your convictions undergirded and firmed up, whichever direction you take. Be aware of what the downsides of your model are. And everyone's model has a downside of some kind. So, and then leave the rest to God. Because one thing for sure, Matthew 15:13 tells us, whatever has not been planted by God will be rooted up. And evolution and the old earth theory are not of God. They're not going to last. God will root them up. Gamaliel said the same thing. You know, you'll either be fighting against God, in which case you're not going to get very far, or you're on God's side. Either way, you'll find out in the course of events. So we'll wait this one out. In the meantime, we'll be good stewards and propagate the truth as we understand it. Any final questions? Yes.
Martians.
You didn't have to see that movie this weekend, did you? Okay, well, maybe get your answers there. There's a fellow named the Amazing Randy. How many people have heard of the Amazing Randy? Yeah, he's a debunker. He shows up on television all the time. And his thing is to debunk pseudoscience. He's not a young earth creationist either. So he probably would think that we're worth debunking as well. But he's done his own crop circles. He basically takes a stick with a padded chain, puts a stick in the center, pulls a padded chain out, and then he walks in a circle all the way around the cornfield, and they all bend over very, very nicely without bruising. And he did this on television many times to say, I can make as many crop circles as you want, and they will be indistinguishable from the ones that people found. So he says they're all hoaxes. Yeah.
Well, then UFOs and people who say they have aliens. If we consider the Earth the center of the universe,
are you
saying that there's no intelligible life?
Yeah, I basically take the no alien view from Genesis 1:14. It says that the rest of the universe outside the Earth was created for signs and seasons and days and years. But in Habakkuk, it says the Earth was created for habitation. So there's a distinction between signs and seasons and days and years, which you can use rocks and gas giants and stars and something that's fit for habitation. And only the Earth was created for habitation, according to Habakkuk. So to me, that's pretty strong that C.S. Lewis was on the wrong track with his space trilogy. All right, we went a little over, so let's pray real quickly and close. Thank you, Father, for having a chance to help shed at least some light on this complicated topic. I pray we'd walk away challenged and that we would look into the wonders of your word and treat it with more respect and open our eyes, Lord, to see more clearly what you would have us to defend and to cling to and to embrace doctrinally. And give us strength, Lord, and courage to confront the world toe-to-toe. I pray that you raise up more individuals throughout the globe to bring your truth to bear on this controversial topic. Certainly your enemy is well entrenched, and we are outside the gates peering in. Pray that the gates of hell will not prevail against your church, even on scientific matters. In your son's name, amen.